I'd like to take your Bibles this morning. Our beginning passage will be from Proverbs chapter 8. Proverbs chapter 8, beginning with verse 11, it says, "For wisdom is better than jewels, and all desirable things cannot compare with her. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion." Then jump down to verse 14. It says, "Counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I am understanding. Power is mine. By me kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me princes rule rightly. I love those who love me, and those who diligently seek me will find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, even pure gold, and my yield than choicest silver. I walk in the way of righteousness, in the midst of the paths of justice, to endow those who love me with wealth, that I may fill their treasuries." You read that passage, and I don't know about you, but I come away and I say, wow! You know, you'd think that wisdom would be the most sought-after possession that all men would seek for. After all, with it comes knowledge, discretion, and counsel. Power, rule, and justice, riches and honor, and enduring wealth and righteousness. You know, didn't Solomon himself prove all of that true? Wasn't all of that bestowed on Solomon because he sought first for wisdom? And again, you'd think people would want that when you see the promise of all that comes with it. Do you know of anything else which can provide the same as wisdom there is promised to provide? And yet, how many people, even among Christians, seek after wisdom for the treasure she is? And even among those who do search, who search for wisdom, so often they look for it in all the wrong places. Rather than courting the author of wisdom, knowledge, and understanding, they turn to every variety of humanist counselors. And by so doing, as Paul put it in Romans chapter 1, professing to be wise, they become nothing but fools. I really love 1 Corinthians chapter 1 for what it says regarding God's perspective on things. It's quite an amazing contrast to see what God views as successful in light of what the world declares success. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 if you would. We won't read the whole chapter, but a little portion of it. First Corinthians chapter 1, and beginning with verse 18. Listen to the contrast. It says, "For the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness. But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom. But we preach the Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block and to the Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks alike, the Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." What a beautiful passage. You could take those verses and the ones that shortly follow there, and you could preach an expository message on those alone. You know, I often go back and I read those to remind me that it's certainly not by anything that I do or am that God accomplishes anything through me. It's by His grace and His mercy and His love and His power that I am what I am, because all the wisdom I could ever muster, which wasn't much in the past, is nothing but absolute foolishness in light of God's omniscient, infinite understanding, knowledge, and wisdom. It certainly doesn't compare. The prophet Daniel testified that, quote, "Wisdom belongs to God. However, neither wisdom nor knowledge can be acquired aside from Yeshua the Christ," which simply attests to the deity of Christ. For Colossians 2:3 tells us that that in Him are hidden, speaking of Christ, in Him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. They're to be found in and through and by Yeshua the Christ, and thus aside from Him they cannot be found. Further, wisdom and knowledge must also come from a study of Scriptures, being as all Scripture is inspired by God, profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. And most specifically, from Proverbs, the Proverbs of Solomon. This will be part two of Gleanings from Proverbs. It's my aim in this short series to not only share with you what I consider the most profound thought from each of the 31 chapters, but more importantly, by doing so, to inspire you to dig further yourselves in Proverbs and in the rest of the Scriptures as well. Why do I want you to do that? Because I want for each of you, whether it be you here on in front of me now or those who will hear this message on the tape ministry, I want for each of you what's described in Psalms chapter 1 and verses 2 and 3, where it says, His delight is in the law of Yahweh, and in His law He meditates day and night. And He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its own season, and its leaf does not wither. And in all that He does, He prospers. I truly desire that for each of you. And so I hope that these messages prompt you, urge you, to get into the book of Proverbs even deeper, and especially all of the Scriptures, because that's what's awaiting for all of us if we do. In the first message, we covered the first 11 chapters, so we'll begin with this message in chapter 12, Proverbs chapter 12. And this is another of those chapters in which it's difficult to choose just one thought which stands out above the rest. However, one it must be, so I'm going to choose verse 17. Proverbs chapter 12, excuse me, not verse 17, but verse 27. Verse 27, it says, A slothful man does not roast his prey, but the precious possession of a man is diligence. Now, how many of you would have answered diligence had I asked you prior to reading this verse, what's the precious possession of a man? No hands are raising up, so I suspect probably none of you. And I would have been surprised if I had just out and out asked that question, what's the precious possession of a man, that any of you would have probably said diligence. I know if I hadn't known this verse, I don't think I'd ever come up with that. Yet think about it, there's very little in life that's ever attained without diligence, or what today probably most people would call stick-to-itiveness, including salvation in Yeshua the Christ. There's a lot of passages that I could use to illustrate this, and I know people have different perspectives on this, but I'm convinced that the weight of the Scriptures prove this irrefutably. But John 15:6, for example, it says, If anyone does not abide in Me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If anyone does not abide in Me, that word abide from the Greek word that it's translated from could have just as easily been translated continue, endure, persist, or persevere in Him. Unless we abide, unless we endure, unless we continue, unless we persevere in the Christ, unless we continue in Him. Do I believe that Christ will throw any of us away once He has us? No. But I do believe that you and I can walk away from Him. He's given us that free will, that choice. And unless we, according to this verse and many other verses, endure and abide in Him, unless we stick to it in our Christian walk, we're thrown away as a dry branch to be burned up. There aren't many of us born with silver spoons in our mouths. So except for those rare individuals, the rest of those in this world who have something to show from this life got it by simply keeping after it day after day after day. Isn't that what Yeshua even told us about regarding our walk with Him? I know I've used it several times recently, but again, Luke 9:23, where Yeshua said, And He was saying to them all, If any man wishes to come after Me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow Me. Diligent persistent pursuit. The quitter in life not only comes away empty-handed, but also wasted a lot of time and effort put into his pursuit prior to his giving up. He would have been better off to have not started down the road at all. As Peter put it, for the spiritual pursuit, in 2 Peter 2 and verse 21, "For it would have been better not to have known the way of righteousness than, having known it, turn away from the holy commandment delivered to them." It's a lot of waste of time, a lot of waste of effort. If you're going to start something and give up, you might as well stick it out to the end. Jockey that always seemed to win was overheard whispering into his horse's ear, "Roses are red, violets are blue. Horses that lose are turned into glue." Or he could have rephrased it, "Horses that quit aren't worth spit." It's been said that life is a lot like pedaling a bicycle. You don't fall off unless you stop pedaling. Diligence is indeed the precious possession of a man. Let's go to chapter 13. Chapter 13, in the first part of verse 10, it says, "Through presumption comes nothing but strife." This verse brought to mind a practice bareback ride I once made years ago, or I should say attempted to make. I nodded for the gate, and one good buck out of the chute, and I was headed for parts unknown. Upon hitting the ground, I was then accosted with chuckles and snide remarks from my buddies for getting bucked off so quickly. And from all indications, that's exactly the way it appeared. There was no reason to believe otherwise. However, they didn't know what I knew. You see, I had failed to take out my glass eye and put on my patch for that ride. And the first good buck out of the chute, my glass eye was jarred unloose, and it was going for parts unknown, headed for parts unknown. I wasn't bucked off. I simply let go so as not to lose my prosthesis. Now, although the evidence seemed to point in another direction, we need to understand that everything isn't always as it appears, as it first appears. I was telling my wife about a story of one of the fellows who recently went to Canada with us, who used to be a truck driver. He was up at the top of Berthoud Pass or Wolf Creek Pass or one of those in the middle of the winter, and it was snowing terrible, and he'd been driving all day, and he was tired, and he pulled over to the side and went to sleep right at the top of the pass. Well, obviously, I don't think it was snowing, actually, when he first parked there, but storm was on its way, and when he woke up, there was just this blizzard in front of him, and he was headed down the hill. Or at least he so thought. The snow was going by, and he started hitting his brakes and over again, and he realized it wasn't doing any good because he was still going down the hill. And he reached over and he grabbed his buddy and said, "We got to get out of here. I can't get this rig stopped." And they both opened the doors and jumped out into a snowbank. And there stood their rig. See, it was an optical illusion. Remember, you know how you sometimes will be sitting in your car and somebody's going by you or pulling backwards? And you think you're the one that's rolling, you hit the brakes. Well, with all that snow blowing by him, he was sure they were headed down the hill, headed for danger. And they just landed in the snowbank next to them with their rig parked right beside them. Everything isn't always as it appears. I can't tell you how many times I've seen this passage from Proverbs 13 and verse 10 fulfilled in my own life and in the lives of others. It amazes me how many times I've seen someone build a case against myself or someone else based on nothing more than presumption. I would venture to say that over 50%, maybe it's more likely 75 or even 90% of the times, that possibly even 90% of the divisions, schisms, and splits in the body of Christ come from nothing more than presumptions. And in light of that, you can see the wisdom of God in demanding that every fact be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And you can behold our foolishness for so rarely complying to that mandate. Even two witnesses don't necessarily guarantee that what they testify to is true. It's very possible, as in my as it was in the case with my bareback ride, that two or more people may think that they witnessed something they didn't. The baseball game was in progress, and the pitcher had just walked three men to load the bases. It was the last of the ninth with two outs, and the fourth batter was at the plate, and the score was tied. When the count went to 3-2, the catcher called time to speak to the pitcher. "Listen, Tom," said the catcher, "we lose the game if you throw another ball, so here's what we'll do. You wind up rear back and throw as hard as you can, but hold on to the ball. Whatever you don't let go of it." So the catcher went back to his position, the ump yelled play ball, and Tom went into his windup. Then with all his might, he made a throwing motion toward the plate. The catcher banged his fist into the glove, and the ump yelled, "Strike three, you're out." The batter couldn't believe his ears. He flung his cap to the ground and screamed at the ump, "What are you, blind? That ball was outside by a mile." Even two witnesses can be wrong. But at the very least, anything we believe or report on should be based on the testimony of two witnesses. And absolutely never, never on presumption. And I'll guarantee you, it's almost far more the opposite that's true. Somebody tells us something, we very seldom even find out, even go to the extent of trying to find out if they're a witness of the fact. And usually they're not. They simply heard it from someone else who wasn't a witness either. Let every fact be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And I'll guarantee we'll have a whole lot less divisions and strife and all that goes with it. This is such an easy sin to fall into that each of us should make Psalms 19 and verse 13 our prayer that says, "Keep back thy servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not rule over me. Then I shall be blameless and I shall be acquitted of great transgression." God sees sins of presumptuousness as great transgression. Let that be our prayer. Chapter 14 of Proverbs. Here's another of those chapters that for me has four or five equally strong thoughts. For this message, let's go to verse 7. Chapter 14 and verse 7, it says, "Leave the presence of a fool, or you will not discern the words of knowledge." It's nearly the same thought that's found in the previous chapter in verse 20. Which says, "He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm." Now, if you yourself are wise, then why should it matter if you choose to associate with fools? Well, I'll tell you why. It's a rule of thumb, and not that there aren't sometimes exceptions to this, but it's a rule of thumb. Generally, it's the case that it's easier for a negative influence to adversely affect the positive than vice versa. Horses, I'll guarantee, sure prove it true. Put an easy-to-catch horse in with a hard-to-catch horse, and I will guarantee you that you will end up with, every time, two hard-to-catch horses rather than two easy-to-catch horses. It'll never work the other way around. The Apostle Paul put it this way in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33. He says, "Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals." You know, we hear often hear of Christian parents who put their children in public school as little evangelists. It ain't going to work. Now, there may be other reasons why somebody may have to do it. But that ain't going to work, I'll guarantee you. They aren't going to be little evangelists in their school. The peer pressure, and especially for someone of such a young age, the peer pressure will be so great upon them that they will be pulled down. They will not pull others up. It just works that way. Bad company corrupts good morals. Again, there may be some few exceptions, but they are few, few indeed. There was a lonely elderly lady that once walked by a pet shop and decided in her loneliness that she'd maybe buy a minum bird that could speak back to her. She took it home with her, But to her dismay, the only thing this bird would say was, "My name is Roxanne, and I'm a swinger." Well, she was quite distraught over it, so she went to her parish priest and told him about the situation, and he said, "Well, I think I can help you with the matter. I've got two minor birds, and they're quite religious. Matter of fact, they're so religious, I named them Paul and Peter because they recite the rosary every day." And he says, "I think if you put your minor bird with my minor birds, I think we'll probably solve the problem." So the lady brought her minor bird over and put it in with Peter and Paul. Immediately, her minor bird said, "My name is Roxanne, and I'm a swinger." And there was silence at first. And then Paul said to Peter, throw away your beads. Our prayers have finally been answered. So let me ask you, who influences who? Solomon put it to a rhetorical question in Proverbs 6 and verses 27 and 28. He said, can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? Why do you think God was so adamant about making no covenants with the wicked, no associations with the wicked? Turn to Exodus chapter 23. Exodus 23 and verses 32 and 33. And there it says, you shall make no covenant, pacts, treaties, agreements with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. And then turn also to verse 34, because it tells us nearly the same, but adds some to it. Verse 34 and verses 12 through 14. Verse 12, it says, watch yourselves that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, lest it become a snare in your midst. But rather you are to tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and cut down their asherim. For you shall not worship any other god. For Yahweh, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. David certainly understood this. Turn to his first psalm. Psalm chapter 1 and verse 1. I'm already there. Let me just read it to you. It says, how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. Don't walk, don't stand, and don't sit with them. Seems to cover it all. Instead, it should be our aim to surround ourselves and our children with godly, wise, positive influences. Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs chapter 15, beginning with verse 1 and 2. It says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise makes knowledge acceptable, but the mouth of fools spouts folly. Also verse 23. And a man has joy in an apt answer, and how delightful is a timely word. And then also verse 28. The heart of the righteous ponders how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things. And there's something more for us to glean from these passages than just what we brought up in the last message, and that is beyond that we need to be a people of few and chosen words. Look at verse 1 again. It says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. It's been my observation that our segment of Christianity isn't necessarily known for their gentleness. You know, I think we've erroneously associated gentleness with either effeminacy or weakness, when in fact, it's just the opposite. It's the real man who can be gentle without having his masculinity threatened. We may very well have more confrontations with our enemies than we should, simply for the lack of applying this particular principle. Turn to Proverbs 17:14. 17:14 that admonishes us that the beginning of strife is like letting out water. So abandon the quarrel before it breaks out. You know, some of us seem to run toward confrontation rather than avoiding it. God's plan is for us to avoid it. Now, that doesn't mean that we back down if it comes our way. You know, and sometimes we even do that, depending on what kind of confrontation it is. But sometimes I think we run toward confrontation rather than avoiding it. Now, I'm not saying either that we shouldn't take a stand where we should. But we need to do it in such a way, so far as it depends on us, that it promotes peace and not war. Verse 28 from chapter 15 again says, the heart of the righteous ponders how to answer. That's the same as simply saying, think before you speak. And again, which is something that I think we probably all could learn from. The Apostle Paul put it this way to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verses 24 through 26. It says, and the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome. You know, sometimes I think by our lives, we think that reads, the Lord's bondservant is quarrelsome. But no, it says, and the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be kind to all, able to teach, patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition, if perhaps God may grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth, and they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. There's much for us to learn from that. That's I sometimes wonder if we don't have in our midst more fools than wise in this light when it comes to how we speak. Chapter 16 of Proverbs, in verse 7. Verse 7 says, "When a man's ways are pleasing to Yahweh, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him." Now that's a general rule, of course. We certainly have our share of opposite balancing passages as well, such as 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12, which says, all who even desire to live godly will be persecuted. Nonetheless, if we are righteous in God's sight, we should also see the fulfillment of Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 7 in our lives as well. It was certainly true in Joseph's life, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's lives, and also Paul's life in Acts 27, and I'm sure there's probably others in the Scriptures that could be named as well. Did they go through times of persecution? Without question. But in their cases, and I'm sure in other cases as well, they also went through those times because of their righteousness where even their enemies were at peace with them. Wasn't that the case with Daniel when he was thrown in the lion's den? Thankfully, God was at peace with him at that point in time because of his righteousness, but really so was the king. He didn't desire for that to be the case. As a result, those who counseled against him were thrown in the lion's den. Wasn't the case with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and Daniel when they first were brought to Babylon? And they didn't want to partake of the foods that God didn't, or the meats that God did not ordain for foods. And they were pleasing in the sight of the man who was in control of them and found favor in his sight. And again, in others as well. It's not always going to be the case. But if we're truly righteous in God's sight, it should be the case at least sometimes. If it's never so with us, rather than trying to excuse it with such passages as 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12, maybe we should first examine ourselves to see whether we are truly righteous or not. Maybe it's not because we're simply persecuted because we're righteous, simply because we're not righteous, that our enemies are not at peace with us at times as well. Chapter 17 of Proverbs, verse 10. Verse 10, it says, "A rebuke goes deeper into the one who has understanding than 100 blows into a fool." Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that to a man of understanding, rebuke or correction is viewed as something positive rather than something negative. It becomes a stepping stone to improvement rather than a stumbling block. You know, a fool will never acknowledge a fault. You find a man who will never acknowledge his fault. Now, be careful that you don't judge a man poorly. I mean, you may see a fault or think that you see a fault and maybe have done everything in the world to convince that man that he's at fault, but maybe he still doesn't see it as a fault. There's a difference between a man who knows he's at fault and won't admit it and a man who never sees that he's at fault. He may be simply blind to it and you haven't been convincing enough to prove him otherwise. But I'll guarantee you a fool will never admit a fault and continually makes excuses for them. Whereas a wise man is one who is never content with his and desires to grow beyond his faults and weaknesses. He's one who's open to admonishment and rebuke if necessary. A man who understands that he has blind spots. Anybody here have blind spots? I'll raise both my hands. I know I've got all kinds of them. But he's a man who understands that he has blind spots and that only others can see, and that unless he permits others to expose them, he can never grow beyond them. You know, if our goal is as Paul's was, that is to become all things to all men so as to save some, then we need our blind spots to be exposed by our brothers and sisters, or we'll never overcome them. Because if they're blind spots to us, you can't overcome what somebody else can see and doesn't point out to you.
we should say, hey, I want to know what they are. It's like, somewhat like David's prayer to God. And he says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try my anxious thoughts and see if there be any hurtful way in me and lead me in the everlasting way. That's the attitude we should have. To be able to be open to brothers and sisters who you can trust and say, hey, I know it may hurt, but man, I need to know where I fall short. The areas I don't see. Because I want to become, I want to improve, I want to become a better servant, a better ambassador for my Lord and Savior, a better witness to others that I might lead some to Him. Earlier in Proverbs, Solomon went so far as to say in chapter 9 and verse 8, he says, do not reprove a scoffer lest he hate you. Reprove a wise man and he will love you. I wonder how many wise men and women there are amongst us. How many of us love reproof? It's not something that's easy to love, is it? But if you're a wise man or a wise woman, you'll love it because you know it's for your benefit and for your good. Why? Because better is an open rebuke than love that is concealed. And faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Chapter 18. Again, another one of those tough chapters to make a choice from. The verse I do choose, I do so because it's one that I know that I have a problem with in this particular area at times, and I suspect that sometimes some of you do too. Verse 13 it says, He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. You know, there are times I get so excited about the answer that I can share with somebody that I don't take the time to listen to the question, and consequently, at times, I provide an answer to the wrong question. I found myself doing it. Matter of fact, I was on this trip to Canada that we made. I found myself doing it there. Matter of fact, God gave me this particular chapter to read in my next morning's devotion, and I was quite convicted of being a fool because I could remember a circumstance that a man started to ask a question, scriptural question, and I never let him answer. He finished his question. In my mind, I immediately knew what the question was, and I jumped right in and gave an answer. And to this day, I don't know whether actually that was the question he was asking because I never gave him a chance to ask it. And usually a man who's put in that position will back off and never ask it after he's went through that to begin with. Consequently, at times when we do that again, we'll provide the wrong answers or an answer to the wrong question. And I do make my apologies to those who I've done that to over the years. If you're like me, we need to be reminded that it's the fool who delights in only revealing their own mind, according to Proverbs 18 and verse 2. As James put it, let us be quick to hear and slow to speak. As has been pointed out so many times, we ought to listen twice as much as we speak. For God gave us two ears and only one mouth. And I thank my wife that she often reminds me of that. She's a good helpmeet to me because she knows my weaknesses and will point them out to me, and specifically sometimes in this particular area. Going on to chapter 19 of Proverbs. Chapter 19 and verse 21. There we find this. It says, many are the plans in a man's heart, but the counsel of Yahweh it will stand. Isn't it amazing how convincing our own hearts can be at times? You know, they can rationalize anything. You know, I know of men who have rationalized living with a woman and not being married. And everything else under the sun. Our hearts, if we allow them to, can absolutely rationalize everything. And for that reason, we should not take lightly the fact that Jeremiah 17:9 testifies to us that the heart is more deceitful than all else, and who can understand it? The heart is more deceitful than all else, and desperately sick, and who can understand it? Solomon put it this way in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 3. He wrote, furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. So much for pleas of insanity for those who commit capital crimes. According to Solomon, we're all insane. Well, at least we have the propensity toward insanity in our hearts if we allow our hearts to rule us. In other words, There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Proverbs 16 and verse 25. The heart of man in and by itself simply cannot be trusted. I don't care whose heart it is, yours or mine. In and by itself it cannot be trusted. However, God's counsel will stand through eternity. Thus, it only makes good sense that we consult Him and His Word in all that we do. Once again, Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6. Trust in Yahweh with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. Acknowledge Him in all your ways, and He will make your path straight. Don't trust your heart. Your heart will lead you astray. Trust Him, and He'll keep you on the narrow path that leads to life. Chapter 20, verse 9. Verse 9, it says, "Who can say, I have cleansed my heart? I am pure from my sin." The obvious answer to that question that's not necessarily answered there is no one. That was Job's answer. Job 14 and verse 4, he put it this way, "Who can make the clean out of the unclean?" "No one," he said. Now, why is that such an important thought? Actually, it's one of the most profound and penetrating thoughts of all times, if you think about it. Never has a thought probably caused so much self-examination in that thought there in Proverbs chapter 20. A thought that has probably driven more men to search for God than possibly any other thought. We all sin and fall short of the glory of God. And consequently, we can neither purify our own selves nor reach God on our own because of it. What does it say in Isaiah? I think it's 53 or 59. God's hand is not so short that He cannot save you, or His ear so dull that He cannot hear you, but your iniquities have turned His face away from you so that He cannot hear, and your sins have made a separation between Him to where He cannot save you. It's a thought. No one can purify themselves. No one can say they've cleansed their own heart. And in that state, it puts us in a position where we're driven to search for another alternative. And of course, that being the only God, it's the thought that drives one to Christ and His atoning sacrifice. At least I can tell you it did for me. When I came to realize that the good in my life would never outweigh the bad, and I couldn't make it to heaven or to God's eternal security, even if it did. And one which at the same time makes a person awfully grateful for it. When you realize put all that you could do, all that a man in all his life, put it all together, all that you could do, and you still always fall short. Doesn't it make one even that much more grateful for the price that was paid and the ability that made it possible? Praise be to God for His infinite wisdom and abundant grace. In ending this message, and before concluding Proverbs, the next message, let us let His Word, His truths, His wisdom, His grace and love propel us to the cross and to the empty tomb. And there's no greater thought that a message could end with than that. In the next message, we will conclude our diggings in Proverbs. Or should I say, we will have just begun our diggings.
Tape was produced by Mission to Israel Ministries. For more information regarding this ministry, or for a list of books and tapes available through this ministry, write Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, 69363.
Peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering and without hypocrisy. Let it be so with us, Father, that we can be better servants, better vessels, better ambassadors, Father, for Your sake, in preaching and proclaiming Yeshua the Christ to a lost world. We're thankful again for Your Word and all that it has for us. We glorify You for it. In Yeshua the Christ.